you hope can be your best player, at a minimum be a top three player on a playoff team. Like, and I think you have to assume that. Because even if you assume the best about Zach Edey, you're thinking about Cedric Howard, Zach Edey, and this guy. Like, that's your core leaving the draft. And given that none of the players we're talking about play center, it sort of doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Anybody else you can talk about is going to fit with the Coward and the Edey. So you just got to get the best player.
Chris, we really appreciate your time, my man. Thank you.
Thanks.
That is Chris Harrington of the Daily Memphian. All right, Cobb, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's think about what are the questions that you're thinking about as we head into draft lottery week in terms of, you know, the best approach, best thought. Like, what are you hoping to start sorting out as we make our way to Sunday and we're all on our best behavior this week so that we make sure the lottery balls go our way? So let's think about that. We'll talk more NBA draft when we come back right after this. Jeff Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. Nobody keeps up with the portal like Cobb. We'll talk about that during the next segment. But Cobb, I've been struggling with the playoffs. I haven't really found like a satisfactory answer of like why I'm not locked in. This weekend helped. Like, I really did find myself, even though DeMichael put it on his list of top five games of the weekend, which I thought was disgusting, there was something about the Orlando-Detroit game on Friday, not yesterday's, Friday's game, that was so disgusting that he was 100% right. It was in the it's so bad it's good category, because what we set, I believe, an NBA playoff record for most consecutive missed shots. There was also something about a team being up 22 points in a game that was in the 70s in the fourth quarter. It's like, if you graded on a curve, that lead felt so insurmountable. And then when it flipped and all of a sudden Detroit had the lead and you thought there was no chance that the Magic could even win the game, there was something that was captivating about watching it. But I do also think a big problem that I'm having is just like the Grizzlies aren't here. And like, what? Like, I also don't want to ignore that.
Like, we can't hate gritty basketball when it's played by other teams if we love it when it's Correct. Played by our team.
Correct.
You know, the Grizzlies, we love that grit and grind era. The rest of the league is like, what is this?
God, you we
know?
Have to go but play them it. Tonight. God, that's gross. Ugh.
Yeah, so I'm okay with it. Now I'll say this. Like, if I turn on an NBA playoff game, I want to see made shots. I need that dopamine hit. Otherwise, I'm going to be looking down at my phone to get my dopamine hit, right?
You know what it was? It's not even necessarily a lack of appreciation for grit. I think the problem in that series was it just became the ultimate hunting of a matchup, ISO ball, and it's weird. Do you have an answer for this? Why is it more exciting when Cade does it than when Paolo does it?
I just feels like there's a little bit more wiggle in Cade's game. Like, he controls the floor, whereas like, because he can spray it around. He can be that facilitator guy. Whereas, like, the ball goes to Paolo's hands to die, you know, and that's going to be it. That's lights out on the possession. Once it gets in Paolo's hands, game over.
And
for better or for worse.
And this, I really do mean that this is not a crap on Paolo, but there's just something about when you're watching it, you're like, this is just not for me. Like,
He didn't have any help. I mean,
no.
Look at that game seven. I mean, Dez was MIA. I mean, I think there was, I mean, Wagner had a good, first half, I think, but like,
and you also can't divorce yourself from the fact that like their best basketball in the series was when Wagner was healthy or healthy-ish.
Yeah, right. And now you've also seen, I mean, didn't Orlando fire Jamal Mosley?
They fired him today. It seems like that has been all roads to Billy Donovan.
Ooh, yeah.
I mean, again, I don't know if that's everybody just doing the math of Donovan's
He was at Florida.
Well, and Donovan was all set to return to the Bulls, and they even apparently were making the interview process like, we want candidates that are in with Billy Donovan, and all of a sudden Donovan steps down, and then you start reading the tea leaves that, hey, man, even if Mosley makes it to the Eastern Conference Finals, like, they probably want to move on. And it goes beyond. He coached at Florida. Cobb, never forget, he was like the Magic's coach for 36 hours.
I had honestly forgotten about that. That would make for quite the saga there. But I also don't understand the fascination with Billy Donovan across the board in basketball at this stage of his career. My man's 60 now. Those two national titles are almost 20 years ago. He's done nothing of real substance in the NBA. And you can argue, oh, well, he wasn't in positions to succeed. Okay, but I don't feel like he's a ceiling raiser in the NBA. And that's what Orlando needs, because they got Paolo, they got Dez, they got Wagner. Like, they need somebody who can maximize this little group they have there. And it looked for all the world as though they were going to pull a 8-1 upset on Detroit, and then they couldn't get it over the hump. And it's like, I don't know. Like, is Billy Donovan going to move the needle there? That just doesn't – I mean, I'm sure the fans would like it because you got a hefty crossover of Florida people, but I don't know what we see in some of these NBA retread hires that makes us believe they're the right fit. And I feel like Orlando, like, they go down that route almost every time they have an opening.
Well, also to your larger point, this is where I wonder if maybe the connecting of the dots is going to fall short, because what we kind of thought last year with all of the openings was, hey, there were some big name guys that got fired, and basically the only one that wound up getting a gig was Mike Brown, right? Like, basically Denver basically decided to run it back with Edelman. The Spurs basically decided to just keep it rolling with Mitch. The Grizzlies decided to keep it going with Tuomas. Kings kept it going with Christie, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think the only real retread, right, was Mike Brown.
No, I know, but in general.
What I'm saying is the league is actually, to your point, the league's kind of getting away from it.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, and the NFL is guilty of it too. It's like, why is Robert Saleh back coaching? And like, are we that unimaginative that, like, oh yeah, this would be a good hire? Like, come on, think outside the box.
I think the problem that you run into, like, if we want to use the Saleh example, I gotta imagine he gives a hell of a interview. Like, he's always struck me as the coach that if he has to give the pump-up speech, his pump-up speech is going to be great, and I feel like that always interviews well. And so you did kind of the outside-the-box thinking with Callahan, and you're like, well, that was a disaster. Like, let's go back to, well, what kind of worked? It's like, well, Vrabel worked. Like, doesn't Saleh feel like he rhymes with Vrabel?
I mean, sure. In a sense... the tough guy, like, retread, sure.
But the other thing that with the NBA that's kind of interesting is it feels like in the NBA, now that everybody's going, well, we have to basically have the guy that knows our development program and can, like, keep it going with studs, like, it makes sense that they're kind of going the developmental route, but it doesn't really feel that satisfying. And then, like, I've been wondering this, where everyone's loving to make fun of the Blazers right now. And anytime you can dub a owner El Cheapo, that's such a great nickname that I'm obviously going to be supportive of any joke that they make. But, like, I keep wondering, What if this approach works and he tries to essentially say, screw going money ball on the roster, but let's go money ball on the coaching, like the coaching staff. Like, we're not picking from a pool of, you know, high school coaches versus NBA, but, like, somebody's going to take the job and the roster is what matters the most. Like, if that works, does everyone pivot to that?
Well, fair enough. By the way, correction. I thought that Mike Vrabel was a retread. He was, in fact, not. I was confusing him with Bill O'Brien, who had been the head coach of the Texans when Vrabel was the defensive coordinator. So I guess the Titans did go with a non-prior head coach.
Yeah, but to your point, almost every other Titans hire prior to that was retread. It was like, is your name Mike? Okay.
That's the thing.
Vrabel was technically a Mike retread. Even though he wasn't a retread head coach, it's just like they needed a coach with a name Mike.
Yeah, well.
Munchak. Who else do we have? There was another Mike in there, I thought. Oh, was McCoy there for a while? Who was all-time good dude? Came in here, was coaching for the Showboats for a while.
Mike Mularkey.
But also, didn't we have a Wizenhunt cup of coffee in there too? I know. Wizenhunt is not a Mike. I know he's a Ken, but he was a retread. Like, it was like we were either retreading coaches or retreading Mikes.
Yeah, they went Mike Munchak to Mike Mularkey to Mike Vrabel.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Robert Saleh. Maybe a nice change of pace there, but. No, the other name for the Magic job that has circulated a little bit behind the scenes that would be endlessly fascinating.
Golden.
Dusty May. Dusty
Ooh.
May.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Dusty does feel kind of like new Donovan, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the spiky hairdo and the...
But also, like,
new kid on the block, like running things in college basketball, young enough to be interesting. But, you know, like, I could see it. You know, you saw some of the, I don't want to say dissatisfaction, but you saw the grind kind of wear on Dusty May after the title when he's talking with Matt Norlander about how he couldn't even celebrate it because he's immediately up back on the phone with portal targets.
Yeah, that's and just pulling one out of Saban's playbook. That was always the Saban would hated being in the national championship game because he was always a week behind in recruiting.
Well, but I felt like Saban loved it. I felt like Saban loved that grind. He'd rather be working on next year's team by early January than, oh, whatever, we got to get this national title game out of the way. But like he loved the process. He loved the grind. Whereas like Dusty, it felt like expected more gratification to come from the title. And I don't blame the guy. It's his first title. You know, and you think this is the zenith, this is the pinnacle. I'm going to get to enjoy this, and then you don't. And it's like, well, what was I doing this for? And I think for Saban, it was always the chase. Whereas some of these coaches have to come to the realization, and maybe Todd Golden's there too, that, okay, what was this chase for? Because I thought it was going to lead me to a place of, like, satisfaction, and it didn't. And it's like Saban, you know, yeah, the titles were the byproduct of the fact that he loved the work. Whereas like these other guys, it's like they put in the work because they think they're going to love the title. And then they don't because they realize the work has already started again. And it's like, if you don't love the work, then the college game is not for you. And I'm not saying Dusty doesn't.
No,
I'm sure. I know he has.
Well, I think there is something interesting about it. Makes sense to me that if all things were equal, I think you'd rather be an NBA coach. I know it is more games and it's more travel and whatnot, but if you think about it, you have more control right now of your roster in the NBA. I think the problem, though, is there are probably more college jobs that you could build a real contender right now than NBA.
So I think the trade-off is you get legitimate time off in the NBA because it doesn't all fall on you. It all falls on you in college. Even if you have a general manager now, in 98% of cases, you're still the one who signs off on guys. You're still the one crunching synergy tape. Whereas you're in an NBA front office, like you may have a certain level of say. You may, you know, like a Greg Popovich had unilateral control of almost anything, right? But it's not always the case. There's a lot of different arrangements for NBA head coaches. And even if you are playing a significant role in the front office sort of stuff, like there's still downtime, even within that. You don't have to coach Summer League if you don't want to. Like you don't have to
You have an off season.
You do. Whereas in college ball now, it's like, all right, we're done with the portal. Well, now guys are showing up to campus, and you know, then we got to do summer workouts, and then I got the youth camp thing, which helps pay the bills, and then your semester starts back, and practices get going, and the season, and the portal. I mean, it just never stops. So that's
what is the
I think
best,
Dusty May.
What's the best job in basketball?
I mean, I think a lot of people would tell you it's probably like head coach of the, I mean, right now, head coach of the Thunder.
Okay, well, I was
Mark Daigneault.
Okay, but I was thinking about like this. If you're Daigneault, you're respected, but if things start to work against you, you're the first.
You're expendable. You're more expendable as an NBA coach.
Like Sam Presti is considered a bigger key to the cog than you are.
Well, it depends. It depends. Do you value, what do you value?
I'm thinking is like, does Shire have the best job in all of basketball?
You could say it, but because he's good, yes. But I think he's also expendable because if they were to, in consecutive seasons, fail to reach the NCAA tournament, he would be fired.
Would you rather have John Shire's job or Dan Hurley's job?
John Shire's.
Would you rather have John Shire's job or Dusty May's job?
Probably John Shire's.
Because I think where you can make the argument for May is if Dusty would have gotten beaten in the Elite Eight, it doesn't reverberate.
We're giving him a round of applause for another great season, you know, whereas the expectations are going to be higher at Duke. So, but I also think the ability to get players is higher at Duke.
I totally agree with you on that.
Ask about Hurley and May. I think it's harder for Hurley and May, even at UConn and Michigan, which attract really good talent. I think Duke sells itself. Now, John Shire's done a remarkable job of closing the deal and of putting pieces together and actually coaching. I think John Shire, though he's not crossed that final bridge and won a title yet, he's among the top five, and this is what's been so impressive, at actually coaching the game. Because I think some of the GMing, like, that's a huge part of it, like, and he's done a really good job of that, but molding really good teams around Cooper Flagg, and then this past year around Cam Boozer, that's, you know, actually figuring out how to deploy the talent that you get. That's where some coaches kind of fail, and it's not as easy as you think it would be. And for him to be as young as he is with no head coaching experience, I think that really, I think John Shire's best days are ahead of him.
Are we overlooking, is the best job right now Mitch Johnson in San Antonio? Because while technically you still have Pop, like, Pop's clearly not in the office every single day, like, scheming. Like, there's a health concern there. You know that you've got Wembanyama through what's going to be considered the prime of his career. They have all this young talent. They still have draft assets. Like, is Mitch maybe the person that you would say that's the one? Because I'm thinking in comparison to Daigneault, while Daigneault has the accolades and you'd probably rather have his roster at least for the next two or three seasons, there's always the idea if something goes south, you're the most expendable. With Mitch, it feels like there's kind of a power vacuum in terms of the roster control. Like, does that maybe give you a leg up?
Yeah, that's the responsibilities feel lower maybe for him than they are for some NBA head coaches, but the talent he has to work with is really, really high.
Right.
And there aren't like the major franchise shifting personnel decisions ahead because they've got it all in place and he's doing a good job.
Yeah. So like your job's just like roll the ball out there, boys. All right. Let's play. All right. Now, as we think about it in terms of the Grizzlies, I think the most interesting question for me is if you could lock in six right now, would you do it? Because I was thinking about it as I'm envisioning how Sunday's going to go. If I see the Grizzlies pop up at six when they're doing the countdown on the show, I don't think I'm going to be upset.
I don't think I'll be upset. And I think I've changed my opinion on this. I think initially I was like, yeah, I'd lock in six. But now I'm of the opinion it's like, well,
what's enticed you? So what's enticed you?
Well, it's like if you fall to eight, you're still going to get one of those really good guards, like from that group, the Darius Acuff, Keaton Wagler, Braden Burries, Mikael Brown Jr., Kingston Flemings, throw LeBaron Filon in there if you want to. Like, you're still going to get one of them. So, like, all right, six versus eight, I'm going to be excited. I mean, granted, I'll say this. Like, if they do end up at eight and it is Mikael Brown Jr., then I'm going to be like, that's not going to be satisfying. But, like, the potential upside, especially of going to one or two, is immense. It's there's an immense difference for me anyway, picking between Darren Peterson or AJ DeBonsa versus that tier of guards. And I'm willing to roll the dice on that. Like, because I remember, man, don't you? I mean, I know you do. Like, the buzz, the change, the shift, the energy, the mood, the way it all changed when the Grizzlies bounced up to two in 2019. I mean, it changed everything. And now we're at the other side of that. But I wouldn't trade it. I wouldn't change it.
No, I'm with you because the reality is, if you can remember where you were when something happens, that is a significant moment.
Yeah, for sure. So it's like you get that moment. If you bounce up to one or two, it's worth the risk. Because if you fall to eight, okay. Like, maybe
well, the other
you're
thing,
still going to end up with a really good guard.
The other thing, though, that I was thinking about, normally it feels like the NBA draft, maybe a player or two, but it feels like, particularly in the lottery, it kind of goes according to plan. Last year, though, wasn't last year... So Cooper obviously went one, no duh. I think most people had Dylan Harper at two, right?
Yeah.
But VJ...
Well, you know, but there was some thought that Ace Bailey could be two, but yes, yeah.
But VJ going three didn't feel like... Like, it wasn't like an, oh my God, but it was like a, okay. Knipple definitely felt like, I felt like most people had Knipple in like the seven range, and then he goes at four. Then Bailey's fallen enough that it's like, well, Utah's like, well, screw it. Give us Ace Bailey at five. Like, what I'm wondering, the reason why I'm mentioning all this is, what if the draft doesn't necessarily go like super according to plan?
Yeah. Okay. So I think in one order or another, it's going to be DeBonsa Peterson and then either Boozer or Wilson. So I think those three of those four will be off the board in the top four. So, well, I know DeBonsa and Peterson will be off the board in the top four. And then definitely either Cam Boozer or Caleb Wilson. Where it could get interesting is at four. Do you take Boozer or Wilson, or who, if you're the Grizzlies or whoever, do you take your first pick of those remaining guards with the fourth pick? Well, then all of a sudden, some team at five was sure they were going to take a guard, but now all of a sudden you either have Cam Boozer or Caleb Wilson at five. Well, maybe you take one of them, or maybe you were just so locked in and married to your guard that one of those guys slips. Like, maybe Caleb Wilson slips to six. Like, maybe he doesn't get to do as much at the combine because he's got the wrist situation. And there's some questions about his perimeter ability on offense. Like, I could see that. Like, I don't think that's totally inconceivable that, like, Caleb Wilson could slip to six. And then, you know, then one of these guards gets pushed down a little further. And, you know, there's a, I don't know, like a Keaton Wagler's there at eight when you didn't expect him or something. You know, I could see that. Like, I don't think that's totally wild. And then it's like, we just assume that 10, you know, through 10, basically, like, nobody's going to roll the dice on a Yaxel or an Adai Mara. Like, if the NBA is changing and everybody's trying to find their counter to Wimby, and we think it's going to be a more defensive oriented league over the next 10 years. Like, what does that do for an Adaimara, you know, who we think is going to be in the late teens? Well, you know, we saw the Grizzlies use a really high draft pick on Zach Edey. Like, we've seen, like, Kaman Malawak last year went, what, 9th or 10th?
What if there's a situation, like, it sucks, but it's like, all right, what if one of these teams, like the Thunder, sitting there at, like, they move up to, whatever, 10, and they're sitting there going, like, all right, we'll probably lose Hartenstein, but we'll take one of these other guys, and that's how we'll, like, I wonder two things. It feels like there's more teams than just the Grizzlies that are trying to figure out the lead guard issue. So our lead guard's going to kind of get treated like quarterbacks would, which is, all right, we got a decent amount in this draft. Like the NFL draft 2 years ago or whatever, 3 years ago, when we had six of the first 12 picks be quarterbacks. Like, what if everybody's like, we don't have lead guard figured out. This is a way to figure it out. We're taking the lead guards. And so that ends up kind of, you know, messing with the presumed draft order.
Well, that's why I think the counter argument to that is, like, somebody over indexes on a big, you know,
yeah.
And it's like, hey, whoa, we didn't see Mara or Merez Johnson or Hans Steinbeck going 10th or 9th.
Yeah.
And then here they are. So I think that's where your surprises can come in. And I agree. I think the combine will be, I think this is probably one of the more interesting combines, because like Aaron Peterson question is such a big deal. And then the, you know, Chris talking about the measurements of these guards, like Kingston Fleming's does not go to Houston if Kelvin Sampson has not measured his wingspan.
Yeah.
Like that's the number one thing.
No, you're 100% right on that. Yeah.
You know, and he's going to measure, his wingspan is going to measure like 6'7" or something. And one of these franchises is going to be like, oh my gosh, did you see that Kingston Fleming's has a 6'7" wingspan? And then all of a sudden, you know, that's going to be a big storyline next week. Mikael Brown Jr., I think probably the most volatile player in the lottery range of this draft. Because on the one hand, you have an incredibly athletic lead guard with unlimited range and almost like a Steph Curry light kind of way about his game. Then on the other hand, you got a guy who has legitimate injury concerns, who showed no real urgency to be on the floor for his college team, who can be streaky, who can be turnover prone. So like I could see somebody talking themselves into Mikael Brown Jr. at 5, or I could see, for all the things I just listed, somehow, some way, he slips to 15, and you know he could be the one from that group who gets punished. You know, I don't know. It's a given that he crushes the interview process, right? So, like, he's a guy that could slip, and definitely volatility there, because I think most of these guards you can look at and reasonably project who they're going to be in 5 to 6 years. You could tell me Mikael Brown Jr. is an all-star in 5 years, or you could tell me that he's on the fringes of the league. Like, I could see either scenario.
All right, let's talk some transfer portal. Cobb updates us on the big happenings of the weekend, including good news for the Vols. Talk about all that when we come back right here on Jeff Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. All right, Cobb, the Vols got some good news today. Juke Harris, the talented Wake Forest product, is transferring to the University of Tennessee. He is withdrawing from draft consideration and going to Tennessee. Is that the most significant pickup we've seen in the SEC thus far?
I would venture to say yes. Kentucky has just continued to swing and miss. Texas has done a lot of good work in the portal. But this Tennessee class, my gosh, offense will finally, for the first time in 5 or 6 years, not be a concern.
They were pretty good on offense with Dalton.
Yeah, but it was Dalton and Dalton only.
That is true.
This one will be a little different. Like, it'll be, oh my gosh, there's like too many mouths to feed. Like, I'm not super worried about that, I don't think, because I think Rick Barnes has a strong enough hand as a coach to where he'll dictate some sort of a hierarchy there. But my goodness, it is ridiculous. I mean, you've got 5 or 6 guys now who have averaged double figures at the high major level or at really good programs. And this is going to be such a different sort of makeup than we've seen since COVID for Tennessee.
All right. Also, Tigers are still the Tigers have still been adding. The thing that I was thinking about this weekend with the Tigers is, and Munns has kind of made the point of, it does feel like a different type of approach for Penny, but if you kind of sort it out, it's not as different as it seems. It's like more of like where they're getting players. But I'm more curious, as somebody's been following the portal to the degree that you have, now that we're seeing more of their roster come together, what do you make of it?
I mean, I think it's going to be the best, most talented roster in the American. And I don't think that was a foregone conclusion. Like 2 weeks ago, people didn't necessarily view it that way. Now, obviously, it changes once you get Jaden Reed committed and once you get Tyleek Wilkes committed, Weeks committed, and then you get, obviously, I mean, I think the big one was you finally got a bigger body with Cornelius Williams. Now, the one thing this team does not have, unequivocally, it is not on this roster, is really high-level rim protection. So you didn't necessarily have that last year. I think people hoped Aaron Bradshaw could be like that. He wasn't. You go back to 2 years ago, you had Dane Danger and Musa Cisse, who could both protect the rim, especially Musa at a really high level. Cornelius Williams, more of an offensive-oriented big, you know, a little under one block per game a year ago at North Alabama. So he's not going to be your interior enforcer on the defensive side of the ball. So, I mean, I think offensively, this team looks really, really solid. Now, from a defensive perspective, I'm not as sold. But this team, this Memphis team, I mean, it's pretty close to a complete team. Like, it's outside of that rim protection. I mean, I think they've got everything they need to go and win the league.
If you think about where the program is right now versus where they were when they made the decision of they're bringing back Penny Hardaway, do you feel like that they can fix
this?
I feel way better.
Well,
it's
not necessarily.
I think the problem is it was so bad at the end. Saying you feel better, it's like, I would hope so. You know what I mean? Like, that was a 13 and 19 team. But what I'm more cautiously optimistic that they've got the systems in place that, like, last year can be more of an aberration.
Oh, yeah. So you've got your pass-first point guard, which they didn't have last year, in Jaden Reed now. You've got a combo guard from the high major level in Brandon Cummings, who can play either guard position. You have a couple of who I think will be really high-quality role players on the wings who can knock down shots, who do not need the ball in their hands to survive as basketball players. Jerry Dang and Rahard Favors. These are spot-up shooters who have good positional size, and they're not ball-dominant players, which is great. If these guys were needing the ball in their hands on every possession, I'd be really concerned. But that's not who they are, which allows for Jaden Reed to be your facilitator, which allows for Tyleek Weeks to take a ton of shots. There might be a little bit of a logjam now in the backcourt when you're starting to look at, like, all right, they got this kid from SEMO, Luke Almodovar, who's got, like, a lot of game. I don't know where he slots in the rotation at this point because, yeah, you also have Josh Holloway. You also have Julius Thetford. So feels like there's a little bit of a logjam on the perimeter with all these guys they've brought in, and maybe a little bit of a shortcoming in terms of the interior. But I think they can play four out. You know, they'll play Jerry Dang or Rahard Favors more as like a stretch four, or Tyleek. You know, you could position them any way you want. You could say Tyleek Weeks is your stretch four, or your offensive oriented four, and then you slot in Favors or Dang at the three, and then some combination of Jaden Reed, Brandon Cummings, Josh Holloway, Julius Thetford. You know, you got a lot of guys now that you can play at the one and the two, and then it's like, all right, what exactly is Fred Smith Jr.? You know, is he more of a physical defensive oriented four? I think that could be the answer, you know, in terms of where he slots in, but, you know, like, they've got a full team. Like, not all these guys are going to get rotation minutes, and I'm not sure exactly who is on the chopping block there, because you want to invest in Fred Smith Jr. You want to give the local kid a crack at rotation minutes. Julius Setford, he didn't come back to then be relegated to a lesser role.
Right.
He comes back because he wants to play a bigger role, right? Like, that's just the way of the world. So then what does that mean for some of these guys they brought in? I think it's going to be a legitimate, serious battle for minutes. And it's almost like you almost wonder if maybe they could have reallocated some of the resources that they used on a couple of these perimeter guys to put towards a better defensive big. I mean, I think if I had to remake the roster in any way, that's probably what I would do. Is like, hey, we got plenty of guards. We got plenty of perimeter firepower. Let's maybe go for, and maybe they tried this, right? Like, the bigs are at a premium. We all understand. Like, Cornelius Williams, I think, can score on the block for you, but can he be that defensive anchor that you need from your five? I mean, that's where my question is at with Memphis. But you look at this team, it's like, all right, they're going to play a perimeter-oriented style, four out. I think they've got what they need to play fast to go up tempo. And I think the pieces definitely make more sense than last year's pieces did.
All right. In terms of what we've seen with people rebuilding, who have you liked the most?
Well, it's hard not to love what Tennessee did. Because you remember, like, the week after the season, it was like, oh my gosh, everybody's leaving. And it turns out, like, Rick Barnes was kind of savage. Like, I think this was kind of part of the plan a little bit. Like, he wanted to remake this roster in a more offensive oriented way. And he has done that at a really, really impressive level. I think for me, a lot of it is about retention. Like, it's about Illinois bringing back Andre Stojakovic and bringing back the Ivicic brothers, you know, and they're going to be right back at the top. And, you know, like, Duke getting Caleb Foster back, like, what? That would, and, you know, Caden Boozer, like, getting both those guys back, like, that was not on my bingo card, especially not when, you know, you're bringing in a really strong class. You're bringing in John Blackwell from Wisconsin. So Duke is absolutely loaded. I low-key really like, too, what Arkansas is doing. Like, it's John Calipari, and it's freshman-oriented, but if Malik Thomas comes back from the draft and Billy Richmond's back, like, they're going to be a force to be reckoned with. So I think the big winners of this portal cycle are the teams that retained top 50 level players. You know, that's become more common now, you know, like the focus on retention, and maybe we got to let some of our role players go so we can afford the big chunk of NIL we got to send to this one or two, you know, top guys. But more and more programs are doing that effectively.
And then on the flip side, obviously, Kentucky is always going to be a part of the story no matter what. How dire is it?
Well, I just wrote about it, which is why I was like 2 minutes late getting on here, because I was trying to finish it up. I think so my angle on Kentucky right now is this. It's not only is Mark Pope struggling and this roster really kind of lacking the high-end pop that it needs, it's also Louisville has the number one ranked transfer class. Tennessee has the number two ranked transfer class. Vanderbilt looks like a top 25 team. Indiana, which is your neighbor to the north, which has been struggling, which stunk last year, they've got the number four transfer class. So it's all of Kentucky's neighbors are putting together really good teams at a time when Kentucky is struggling. And then I'll give you two more. All right, it's only natural to compare Kentucky to Arkansas now that John Calipari 100%. Is the Arkansas coach. Well, they look great. They look like a top 10 team. And then BYU, which is where Mark Pope came from, all of a sudden they've gotten a whole lot better at getting players and at keeping players now that Mark Pope isn't their coach. And so it's not only is Kentucky struggling, it's like all these teams that you would compare Kentucky to, or that Kentucky has a rivalry with, or that Kentucky borders, like, they're all killing it. And like, that only makes it worse for the Kentucky fans to see their neighbors and their rivals really thriving this offseason.
I think also the other lesson is, in this era, you're only going to have momentum for so long, and you got to pay it off. Because it felt like, you know, they're so happy to be out of the Cal era, and they're bringing back a CAT cat, and everybody's happy. The offense looked better. Yeah, I got to a Sweet 16, and kind of goes a certain way, but here we go. We're pushing all the chips in. $20 million roster. Here we go. And you don't pay it off for a myriad of reasons. Injuries, pieces coming together, like all the reasons. And it's like, man, in this era, it is just so quick to lose all of it.
Yeah, it's on zero right now. The moment. Okay, so get this. Of the top 80 transfers, only three are left uncommitted, and all three are going through the NBA draft process. So, like, where is Kentucky going to find that star power? Where are they going to find the player at this point in the calendar who's going to push them into the preseason top 25? Like, they might be able to win a bidding war for Allen Graves if he withdraws from the draft, but, like, there's going to be about, you know, LSU's going to be going after all these guys because they have one player, you know? So, like, they're not the only team trying to outbid, you know, for this limited pool of players from the transfer portal who are actual needle movers who are still uncommitted. And so, I mean, the way I put it is, like, there's still a couple of Hail Marys away from this thing looking like it's going in the right direction. And it's, to your point, they lost all that momentum. Because coming out of year one, you were like, okay, like, he can put together a team and he can coach them up. And then year two was an absolute disaster. And now the momentum is just gone. I mean, the rejection after rejection after rejection. And then it snowballs. And then it's like people start to look around, you know, in the industry, and they're like, well, there must be a reason. There must be a reason why players aren't going there. And then it's like, well, I don't want to be the one to go there because clearly there is something amiss there. And I think we're looking at a situation where Mark Pope is going into year three at Kentucky on the most scalding hot seat that you could possibly imagine in college basketball. I think that's where we're at.
All right, Cobb, we appreciate you switching days for us, my man.
Yeah, man, no problem.
That is David Cobb of CBS Sports. When we come back, we tell your story next, right here on Jeffrey Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN. All right, George, for today's Don't Tell These Story, tell your story. A guy that we like, Jaylen Brown, a day after the Sixers knocked off the Celtics in Game 7, he hopped on Twitch, which is always a great idea. That's the thing about basketball in this era, where y'all have your brains turned off and you just look at analytics. Y'all have no idea what y'all are talking about. Flopping and exaggerating contact is different. It's like when somebody barely touched you and you're selling a call to make it seem like you just got shot. This is just my personal opinion on basketball. Some of you might disagree, but argue with your grandma. Flopping has ruined our game. Joel Embiid is a great player. One of the best bigs in the effing basketball history. He flops. He knows it. This ain't breaking news. Every player does it. So why are you targeting me? They clearly had an agenda, they being the refs. Maybe because I spoke and was critical of refs in the regular season, so they responded. You're going to lead me. You're going to lead the playoffs in offensive fouls. That's how that was. The response from the officiating crew, you could clearly tell. So,
you know, can we give him one thing? He is consistent about complaining about flopping. He's consistent. I'll give him that.
I 100% agree. And there's also a lot of points that I agree with. I do think also a lot of it is he's not figured out how to push off and get away with it.
Also, timing.
No, it's loser talk.
Timing. Come
it's
on,
loser
buddy.
Talk.
Like,
no,
come on.
It's loser talk, but I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
I just think a huge part of it is he hasn't figured out how to push off and get away with it.
Are his arms too long? Because Dez can do it. Dez does it.
I think there's something related with being, like, stiff.
Maybe. I could see that.
Because he's, like, a stiff ball handler, too. Like, I just think it's not as, like...
He's not as fluid with
correct.
It. Yeah.
I think there's something with it. All right. Want to thank Cobb for being with us, as well as Chris Harrington and CJ Hurd. If you missed anything, it'll be up on the podcast shortly after the program ends. For George, for Cobb, this is Jeffrey saying thanks for listening. Keep listening. The Gabe Kuhn Show is coming up next.